You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 1st, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. Happy New Year, ladies and gentlemen. We are broadcasting live to tape. Just steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, Brooklyn, USA. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, we all made it. It's 2015. Now, with that said, I'm actually recording this in 2014 because I'm on vacation. So I'm not sure that we actually made it. It's possible no one's ever listening to this because we got hit by that meteor or whatever it is.
Matt looks pretty ill.
Matt, I don't know that he will make it into 2015. Make sure you, pre-publish this thing. Don't speak into the microphone. I don't want to get you germs.
Don't worry. I'm drinking a lot of ginger ale.
Yes. Oh, my God. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a best of show because we are on vacation to return within just a number of days. I right now am so hungover because, of course, last night was New Year's, and you know how I roll on New Year's. I spend 2 hours putting Saul to bed at starting at about 7. He goes to sleep at about 9. Then I have about 2 hours worth of arguments with my 9-year-old daughter, Mila, as to how late she can stay up. She manages to cajole us into staying up until 11:30. But we pass out, fall asleep at about 10:45. And so she wakes us at like 1 in the morning and says, "Hey, I need to go to bed now." And we're like, "What? Okay, go to bed." And she's like, "Well, I can't. You need to put me to bed." And I'm like, "You're 9 years old. It's 2015. Come on. Be more mature and go to sleep, for gosh sakes." And then we argue.
"Do you still need your binky, Mila?"
"Yeah, no kidding. What, did you take a poop in your pants?" And then she's like, "You're not talking to me appropriately. You're not talking to me like I'm 9.
And incidentally, yeah, I did.
And then, so that's why I'm so hungover today, because of all the arguing that was involved in ushering in the new year. With that said, very happy to present you this interview that we did with Bill Lozonik. I think we did this in September, if I'm not mistaken, of 2014. Not 100% sure when we did this one, but I do remember exactly what it was about. Longtime listeners of this program will know that I cite Bill Lozonik's work as professor from UMass extremely often. I don't know at rate, but there's two sort of seminal things that he has studied, and both involve the relationship between stocks and what has happened to wage gaps. And the first of his research involves how CEOs and board of directors were compensated starting in the 1980s because of changes in the tax law. They got a lot of stock options. And essentially what happened is that corporations, which used to have the primary function of building things and doing long-term capital investment into their future, because the incentive shifted for CEOs and board of directors to just essentially having a cottage industry, and that's where they get make their money. And that cottage industry is getting their company's stock prices up. And the ways you do that don't necessarily align with things like investing in a community, investing in your workers, investing in the research and development, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that has been one of the biggest drivers in his mind of wealth inequality and the wage gap in this country. And the other work he's done is on stock buybacks. And that is what this interview is about. A very important work that has been recently, it was cited by Nick Hanauer in his piece. We interviewed him last week when he was talking about overtime pay. So Lozonik is a very important, underheard from, undersourced source in this country. And so I wanted to include it in the best ofs because I think it's really important stuff. And of course, like you can almost always count on stuff that I think is best of being dry and very weedy. But again, that is what the Majority Report is here for. You want something different? Find it anywhere else because that's where you will find it. But this is one of the few places you'll find it. And then, of course, Matt's going to include some other tidbits from the member show that's going to make you laugh and cry, maybe just laugh. I don't know, possibly cry, but maybe laugh. And so enjoy, and we'll come back tomorrow with our final best of the New Year's vacation. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Professor William Lozonik, economist from UMass and the co-director of the Center for Industrial Competitiveness, on his piece in Harvard Business Review, Profits Without Prosperity. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And this follows up in many respects on your book, Sustainable Prosperity in the New Economy. Let's talk about sort of the premise or the situation that we find ourselves in this context of our economy now.
Okay. I think the problems are generally recognized, that there's been a huge concentration of income at the top. Now, of course, Thomas Piketty has his unexpectedly best-selling book out there, Capital in the 21st Century, but the most valuable part of that book are the data that he's been collecting for some time on the top 1%, the top 0.1%, and I have actually been using those data for, well, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, and they're very valuable. They show us that over what's happened over a century to the income distribution, and year by year we just see this concentration of income at the top. But the other thing that we see is that people can't find good, stable employment. And it's not just people who only have high school educations. It's people with college education, people who should be able to find jobs fairly easily in the economy. And the book you mentioned, Sustainable Prosperity in the New Economy, and a question mark after that, Business Organization High-Tech Employment in the United States, which came out in 2008. I started really writing that around 2005, and I could see I've been tracking both this concentration of income at the top, the loss of middle-class jobs for some time from the 90s on various research projects I was involved in, and I could see what was happening. Of course, when I started writing that around 2004, 2005, things didn't look so bad. The economy was kind of booming, but the jobs still weren't there in the way they had been before, certainly in the way they had been in the 1980s and even in the 1990s, in the late 1990s, in the internet boom. So I decided to focus in that book on the information communication technology industries, the industries which really came out of the microelectronics revolution, the internet revolution, and look, say, okay, here are college-educated people in a booming industry. They should be the best situated to find jobs, and found that, in fact, they weren't very well situated, and the situation was coming worse. And it was for two reasons in terms of the way employment relations had changed. The first was that up through the 1980s, basically if you got a job with Hewlett-Packard, IBM, Motorola, Texas Instruments, a whole number of other companies in the economy, and generally with any major Fortune 500 company, and particularly if you had a college education, you basically had a career, the expectation at least of a career for life with that company. And you had, you could build on that over time. You'd, your pay would go up over time. You had a defined benefit pension at the end. And all that started to change, actually changed quite dramatically in the 1990s. But for those people, it was kind of masked by the fact that there were all these startups, there's all these other opportunities in the economy. And that started to really change with the internet boom and bust as it occurred in 2001-2002. They started talking in 2002-2003 about a jobless recovery. And one of the things we saw is that, in fact, there were a lot of highly qualified people in places like China and India, often employed by the same companies, who could do those jobs and generally do them for less pay. But the important thing is that they were highly qualified by this time. So people who would supposed to be best situated in the economy to get good jobs, all of a sudden found that, well, they weren't so well situated, particularly if they were in their 40s and 50s and the companies laid them off, as increasingly they did. So that was basically what the first part of the argument that I made about the change in employment relations that had occurred in this transition to what I call a new economy business model. But the second part of it, which is what this Harvard Business Review article focuses about on, and what something I've been looking at really since the 1980s, the late 1980s, when the phenomenon started, was companies were not only declining to give secure employment to workers with a lot of skill, a lot of education, but they were taking the profits that they were making and just distributing to shareholders, who basically, and I can go into this, have nothing to do with the company other than buying and selling shares, and not just paying them dividends, which is the traditional way in which you pay people a return who are holding shares or give them a return on the investment they made in the stock market by holding the shares, but something which really came in on a large scale in the 1980s, which was stock buybacks, repurchasing stock. And unlike dividends, which give a yield for people who hold shares, buyback reward people who sell shares, who get out of the company. And I've been watching this for some time, and over the last decade, or really after 2001, they became massive. They were already pretty large in the 90s and 1997 for the whole corporate economy. Buybacks as a form of distribution to shareholders surpassed dividends. But they came massive in after 2000. And between 2003 and 2007, I was tracking it year by year. You saw that for the S&P 500 companies, or really similar to the Fortune 500 companies, largest 500 companies in the United States generally, they were going from about $300 million per year on average to $1.2 billion. So by 2007, just before the financial crisis, $600 billion in money was flowing out of those companies just to try to give their stock a manipulative boost. And that declined a bit in 2008, 2009, but now it's back again. And so what we have now is a huge amount. Companies have record profits, these companies. They are, however, not using it to invest in innovation, particularly innovation that can have an impact over the long run. They're not using it to keep their employees employed. In fact, just the opposite. You'll find a company like IBM will be laying off employees so it can do more buybacks, get its stock price up, get its earnings per share up. In fact, in the case of IBM, they set that as a goal of what their company is all about. And basically, I can go into much more detail how this occurs, but it's destroying the U.S. economy. I mean, it's not just bad for the people who don't have jobs. It's basically turning the U.S. into a second-rate economy.
So essentially what we have is a story of value extraction from these companies versus a value creation. And let's, I mean, let, and part of this is essentially tied into the, I guess, the incentive structure for the leadership of these companies. Let's start there, and then you can walk us through what these stock buybacks, what they mean, and how they take place.
Yeah. Okay. So the question is, if these are so bad, not just for the economy as a whole, but for the companies themselves. I mean, this boost that they give to when you go and you buy back your stock, it's a temporary boost. By the laws of supply and demand, when they do what are called open market repurchases, which are the type I'm mainly talking about, people who control that money inside the company, the top executives, are just throwing this out kind of into the ether, giving it away. And then you say, well, why are they doing this? And in the Harvard Business Review article, I go through the various reasons that they give. One is, well, our stock is undervalued and we're making an investment.
Well, before we go through these reasons, walk us through.
Okay. Well, if you want to get to the bottom line of this, why are they doing it?
Well,
reasons.
Just explain for people what a stock buyback is.
Okay. A company has some, generates cash, can even borrow to do them, but assume it generates cash, and then there's a question of what is it going to do with that cash, you might call it with its profits. And, in fact, when companies grow and they're healthy and the economy is healthy, what they do is they keep their experienced workers employed, they pay them higher wages because, in fact, they contributed in the past to generating those profits. They invest in new technologies. And also they pay taxes to the government, which actually invests in technologies too, which are useful to these companies and also in infrastructure, et cetera. So a whole lot of things depend on what's done with profits. Companies always have paid out dividends to shareholders. Shareholders basically are just people, who, like me, who buy or sell shares, and we have nothing to do with the company. We don't really even invest in the company. We just buy other people's shares. Okay, that's a traditional way in which people who hold shares on the public stock markets get a return on that portfolio investment. But what the stock buyback is an additional way of doing this. And as I said before, it's a way of not giving people a return for holding shares, but actually giving the price a boost so that they can sell their shares at a higher price, get out of the company. Okay, so the way this is done is, you've got the stock market there. A company goes in and they do what's called open market repurchases. So they tell their broker, we want to today buy back $200 million worth of stock, or we want to do it for the next week. And that is going to give their stock price a boost. Presumably people start noticing that their stock price is going up, and it might give it some more momentum. Now, in general, the only people who know about this the days they're actually doing it are the top executives who order them to do it, and I guess their broker. And that's a problem in and of itself because there's some inside information there that potentially some people in the know can trade on, but none of us know whether they do or not because even after the fact, they now tell us how much buybacks they did every quarter, but really the issue is what precise days did they do them. Now, that amount can be very large, and it's actually, and I say this in quotes, it's regulated. And so let me talk a bit about why they're allowed to do this. In many countries, until the late 90s in Europe, buybacks were illegal. They still are in many places because they were seen as being a potentially a way of manipulating the stock market. Now, we do have a regulatory agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, set up in 1934 to eliminate manipulation and fraud in the stock market. And for a long time, many decades, that's what the Securities and Exchange Commission tried to do. And one of the things that concerned a lot of the regulators in the Securities and Exchange Commission in the 50s, 60s, and throughout the 70s was this potential for a company to manipulate its stock price through large-scale stock buybacks. So they tried to push through some regulation on this to limit the amount that could be done, to disclose when you were doing it. And if, in fact, you went over a certain amount, you could be charged, or the executives who order these buybacks could be charged with manipulating the market. Okay, and there was a regulation that was proposed, that was never passed, but that was what the regulators would try to do. Now, that changed very quickly in the winter of 1981. And probably the most important thing that happened in the winter of 1981 is Ronald Reagan became the president of the United States on a platform of deregulating the stock market. And one of the first things he did was he appointed a new head for the Securities and Exchange Commission, a guy named John Shadd. Now, John Shadd had been a executive of E.F. Hutton, a Wall Street brokerage firm, a retail brokerage firm, and he was a believer in Chicago-type economics, that you've got to make markets efficient, that if you regulate markets, there'll be less trading on markets, they'll be less efficient, and if they're less efficient, there'll be less capital available to companies, so let's make those markets more efficient, get the regulators out of there. He also happens to have been, the reason he got appointed, probably, is that he was the first Wall Street executive to come out to support Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign of in 1980, and he was, in fact, the head of the campaign for New York State. So this was kind of his reward. Very quickly, the rules were changed, and this is a rule called Rule 10b-18, which was passed really under the radar in November of 1982, which basically said that a company had a safe harbor against being charged with manipulating the market if its stock buybacks were 25% or less of its average trading volume over the previous 4 weeks. Now, that translates into, let's say, for a company like Microsoft, $200 million a day, $250 million a day. ExxonMobil, one of the big repurchasers, $250 million, $300 million a day. Actually, for Apple, it translates into about $1.5 billion per day. And that can be done day after day after day without having any fear that you'll be charged with manipulating the market. So important point here is that it's actually on the, you know, it's there's a notion within the SEC that this could be manipulating the market. Now, whether that large amount is manipulating the market, you know, you have to, well, I think it is. Now, the other thing about this rule, which was different than what had gone before when they actually tried to regulate the market, there was no presumption that if you went over the 25% that this would necessarily be manipulation. And the third point, which is really an important point, is the SEC does not require any disclosure about when you actually do these buybacks. So the SEC doesn't actually know if they're going over this 25% limit, which is in any case quite high.
And it seems to me they can't measure as to whether or not it's actually what impact it's having on the stock price, right?
So we don't know. And now, here's the other part of it, is that executives why do they do it? Okay, and I can come back to it if you want, and about the reasons that they give, which don't hold water, and this is what I do in one part of that Harvard Business Review article. The reason they do it's quite simple. They get paid to do that. So if you take for 2012, which is the latest full data set that I have, and you take the 500 highest paid executives that are reported on proxy statements, and this is in Standard & Poor's puts out its executive comp database. This is what I use. And not all of them are CEOs, but let's say about half of those 500 are CEOs of the companies. But if you take their average total compensation from all the different components of compensation, it was about just a little over $30 million on average, $30 million on average for those executives.
$30 million per year.
Yeah, for that 1 year. It varies, and it varies a lot according to the state of the stock market. Okay. 82% of that $30 million was stock-based pay. About 40% was gains from exercising stock options, and about 42% were the gains realized on the vesting of stock awards. Stock awards have become more and more popular, and usually they have tied to them some. They get triggered when you have an earnings per share target that you hit. So they're tied to the short term performance of your stock. The same with stock options. Although stock options, you'll give them to an executive, and they'll they have to wait at least a year to exercise them, 1 to 4 years. But then they have up to 10 years. In a window in which they, long window, big door, in which they can exercise them, but they're going to gain depending on the timing of those exercises. And we don't know this, but it must be going on. And executives who know when those buybacks are being done could be trading on inside information. Now,
and so,
on the face of it, that would be illegal, but actually, it's not only don't know, the SEC has never even looked into the matter. So it's just something that is totally, in a sense, unregulated. Not only unregulated, but since 1982, basically encouraged companies to do this. And more executives then were given incentives, gave themselves incentives through kind of their boards and sitting on each other's boards and a whole kind of inside job of the way they get their pay up, which I could go into, to incentivize themselves to get rich. Well, in fact, they're destroying their companies.
Let me recap here, because basically what you're describing is, you know, what you see in the movies about those penny stocks with a pump and dump scheme.
Yeah.
They pump up the price of the stock by using the company's profits to buy the stock back. It pushes the prices up. The dump only happens for a small group of people, those being the executives themselves, who receive their compensation in the form of options and vested stock. And I guess
if they own the stock, they might do it that way, you know, if they have it. But the point is that these are not penny stocks.
Right. And
these are 500, you know, I'm the data set I use is 70% of the market capitalization, 70-75% of the market capitalization of all corporations in the United States. 500. Let me give you some other statistics, how important large corporations are to the U.S. economy and therefore what they do. Okay, there's about, the last data were collected by the census in 2007. There were just under 2,000 companies in the United States that had 5,000 or more employees. Okay, those 2,000 companies, they were, I think, a tiny, tiny fraction of all the companies. Obviously, there's millions of companies out there that are registered. But those companies had about 33% of the employment in the business sector of the United States, and that's about 83% of total employment, with the government being another 17%. So they had a huge proportion of the employment, about 37% of the payrolls, and about 43% of the revenues. Now, what those companies do or don't do also affects small businesses and people who are consulting for those companies, restaurants, hotels, where they operate. If those companies don't invest, don't employ people, don't pay people higher wages who have worked hard for them and help generate the profits, don't support the economy, the local, state, and national level that have supplied them with infrastructure, with educational services, all kinds of things without which they could operate, our economy would not have ever become the world's leading economy and can't remain a prosperous economy. It comes down to that. And that's why this issue of what these big companies are doing is so important, because, in fact, so if we take the last decade, 2000, this actually updates data that's in the Harvard Business Review article, 2004 to 2013, a decade, you take those 500 companies, and there's about 450 of them that were listed for that whole period, 54% of their net income went to buybacks, another 34% to dividends. So there's very little left over once they've done that, that can go to higher wages for their employees, to job security, to new additional new investment that other than what they've done, let's say their R&D investment, which is already before profits, but adding to that to respond to new competition. When you add into that the well-known fact that a big portion of the profits of these companies are held abroad, and in fact we have crazy tax laws that encourage them to do that actually go back to 1960, we then start to understand why what I call profits without prosperity, why we have companies that have now record profits in the last few years, and people just are looking out there and saying, hey, where's the prosperity? Where's the jobs? Where's the employment security? Where's the higher wages? I would say it's because of this.
So before this practice sort of start to gain momentum, and part of the things that I know that we've talked about in the past was that the part of the incentive in the first place to give executives stock options and stocks as a form of compensation was a function of the changes in the tax code, whereby they would get lower taxes because as stocks, they would be paying capital gains taxes on this stuff as opposed to wage taxes.
That I think is one of the things we talked about a few years ago when we had the discussion. But let me just summarize that, because it's what basically happened in terms of executive pay, and this is an interesting contrast, is you have to go back to 1950, and when tax rates, we had a very progressive personal income tax structure. the highest marginal tax rate was 91% on incomes at that time of over about $200,000. And executives lobbied after World War II to try to get their a part of their income taxed at a lower rate. And they hit upon stock options, which they actually had to hold the stock for about a year after they exercised them. But they could then claim the gains at the capital gains tax rate, which was 25%. So that came into effect in 1950. By a decade later, this started to be noticed by people, including there was an article in Harvard Business Review by the dean of Harvard Law School in 1960, which said, "Have stock options gotten out of hand?" And it said, "Hey, this is compensation income. Why are they getting capital gains, a treatment on this? They're not putting any money in there. They're not risking any money. This is part of compensation income." And Albert Gore, the father of Al Gore, who was a senator from Tennessee, then took this up as a big issue. Over the course of the 1960s and right up to 1976, under both Democratic and Republican administrations, they got rid of that tax privilege for executives. So surprisingly enough, you had a time in this country where they didn't just do whatever executives wanted them to do. And so at that time, compensation consultants were saying, oh, stock options are dead. Okay, what came back from the 1980s had nothing to do with capital gains tax versus personal income tax. All the tax rates were lowered. Of course, that was part of the Reagan Revolution and part of the ideology that you if you want people to invest in the economy, you got to give them lower tax rates. Well, of course, what we see here is just the opposite. Executives are avoiding tax like crazy for themselves, for the corporation, so they have more profits to buy back stock. And this is not leading to investment in the economy, just the opposite. So if we take actually data, there's just a different type of data that's from the Federal Reserve puts out, which is net equity issues minus buybacks, basically, and shares taken off the market from mergers and acquisitions. For the last decade, it's minus $378 billion per year. So basically, corporations fund the stock market. The stock market doesn't fund does not fund corporations. And what happened is that through just giving them stock-based pay, executives were given the incentive to do this, to get their stock price up and to make out for themselves. It's stock-based pay, which requires no risk on their part. So here's one example of this. Up until May of 1991, if you were a top executive and you exercised your stock options, there were rules that were on the books of the Securities Exchange Commission. Again, the agency is supposed to regulate the stock market. Up to that point, and this went back to 1934, that said as kind of an insider, you had to wait 6 months before you sold the stock. Okay, well, executives didn't like this because in the 6 months, you know, they could exercise the options, have the stock, and the price could go down. So they got the rule changed. And May 1990, from then on, as soon as they exercise the option, they can sell the stock and take the gains for themselves. So basically what you have in place is a system where, you know, yeah, it's pump and dump, but it's the top executives of the largest corporations who are doing this and enriching themselves in the process.
Can we measure and can you just sort of give us a sense of just this money that they're basically extracting from the company, right? I mean, and this concept, I think people get, you know, even on my in my little enterprise here on the Majority Report, the bottom line is I need to take a certain amount of money out of the company as my income. I don't have the stock options and whatnot. But if I was to get what I need for my income and then plus I plug it back into the company and I expand the company, I hire another person, I start doing more shows, whatever, I do better video, I hire someone to build a backdrop, all this. This is all actually issues that we're dealing with here now. In this instance, we have a situation where I am incentivized not to grow the company, but just to increase its stock value. We don't have stock value here, but I'm pretending for a moment, because that's the way I'm going to really make my money. Do you have a sense of just how much less sort of corporate growth, company growth and company reinvestment has been lost to this extraction?
Okay. Well, yeah.
I mean, it's apples and oranges, obviously, because we don't have the same companies.
Okay. So in the Harvard Business Review article, I have a graph, which is the relation between real productivity growth in the economy and real wage growth. And what it shows is that from about 1946. I think the data go till about 2012 or 2013. They might even be go to there. Forget how recently, but right up to the present, basically. From 1946 up until the late 1970s, real wages tracked productivity growth. Okay, now, well, how did that happen? Well, I would argue the main reason was that these corporations were very powerful then, as they are now, but they had a different set of employment practices. Once you got, as I said, once you got a job with one of these companies, is the expectation would be that you were there for a career and your pay would go up over time. And that was true not just for white-collar workers, but for blue-collar workers who did this through collective bargaining, by and large. Okay, and so when we see that at the macroeconomic level that we had growing higher standards of living, higher real wage growth over decades until the inflation of the 1970s hit, which changed things a lot, that you had real wage growth and higher standards of living going not just to a few people at the top, but actually around 1970, if you look at the Piketty data, that was the point at which you had the least concentration of the income at the top, and other data show that you had this trend toward more income equality in the post-war two decades. I would argue the main reason for that, absolutely the main reason for that, was these employment practices of large corporations. It was particularly good for white males, because women weren't as represented at that time. Certainly African Americans weren't as represented at that time among these long-term employees. But you had this trend for more toward more income inequality. Now, what happens from the late 1970s is you then see a wedge, a gap, between productivity growth and wage growth. Wage growth grows much more slowly, and you can see it visually that there is a growing gap that grows and grows and grows right up to the present between the productivity the economy is generating and the wages that people are getting. Now, that is because the gains that are being made in those companies are not being shared in that way. Companies will lay off people at a drop of a hat. They'll get people to work harder without hiring more people. They will move overseas without worrying about the fact that people who have worked for them for 20 or 30 years all of a sudden are without employment with no chance of getting new employment. Basically, it's a whole different ethos of which set in the 1980s about for whom companies are run and who should gain, and it all became focused around stock price.
Now, Bill, let me ask you this too. Now, and I'm looking at this graph, and it's clear that it's had an impact on wage growth, right?
Yeah.
Because essentially, this money is going into the hands of executives rather than being put back into the company in the form of paying employees incremental.
Let me just make one point about that. It's not just that it's going in the hands of executives. So I gave that figure of $30 million on average for the 500 highest paid executives. So this is their employment income. This is not property income. This is employment income. Okay, that's a big number. It's actually about 600 to 900 times the average worker. Okay, it's a huge number. It's a huge number historically. It's a huge number today by international comparison. However, if you distributed that money to workers, there would be some gain, but not a whole lot. That's not where the damage is done. It's the buybacks where the damage is done. So let's just say hypothetically that a company, as is often the case, can do $1 billion in buybacks this year, and that enables their stock price to increase, and through ways that we can't even see, the executives can cash in their options, hit their stock award targets, and make, let's say, an extra $50,000. You say, okay, well, $50,000, that's just a tiny fraction of $30 million. It's not the $50,000 that's the problem, although that's going into their pocket because of this manipulation. It's the $1 billion in buybacks. And it goes beyond just that money, because what it means is that these people who control the resources really the allocation of resources, not just in these companies, but when you add it all up in the economy as a whole, a huge amount of resources. They're not just it's not just that they're failing to share it with their existing employees, but they're not investing in
right.
in the new technologies, the plant and equipment, the technologies and supporting the government to do this, which it needs, that are going to create prosperity in the future. Going even further than that, I would say, it's hard to prove this, I would say at some point they become incapable of doing that. That anybody who's running a large corporation and routinely is, as let's say Steve Ballmer was when he was the CEO of Microsoft, is willing to just throw $10 billion a year out there to people who do not matter to the company, except maybe that Bill Gates likes it because it increases the value of his foundation. They can't possibly, in my view, at the same time, they have to be schizophrenic to be able to have a vision of the future of a technology company. And I think it shows up in the results.
Let me just recap here too. We're watching the benefits of the company go to the executives at an increasingly higher rate than it does the employees. But it's also that this money is being allocated in such a way because it does help the executives in terms of their pay, but it also hurts the future prospects of the company itself because it's no longer in the business of saying, this is our 20-30-year plan. We're going to invest in new machinery today. We're going to invest in new markets. We're going to invest in new job training. Really, what we're just investing in is increasing the value of the company today, because that is what I am incentivized to do as an executive now. In the future, we can all just sort of wink and nod at each other. It doesn't really matter that much.
That's right, yeah. And not only are they incentivized to do this, so this is the other part of the puzzle here, is, and I was around when this happened in the 1980s. I was working, I had been a graduate student in the Harvard Economics Department in the early 70s. I was a faculty member there from 1975 to 1984, and then for a couple of years I was a research fellow at Harvard Business School and maintained close relations with people at Harvard Business School, particularly people doing business history, a well-known business historian named Alfred Chandler, who I was very close to, who were looking at how the U.S. economy had become successful. And at that time, in 1985, actually, the president of Harvard University, the dean of Harvard Business School, went out of their way to hire a guy named Michael Jensen, who was an advocate of maximizing shareholder value, the guru, the academic guru of maximizing shareholder value. And he, more than anybody else, but a whole number of people, and they were all trained at Chicago. He had come through University of Rochester, which was an even more extreme version of free market capitalism than Chicago, to Harvard Business School. And they were arguing that what companies should do is just distribute cash to shareholders. They're the only ones who take risk, and they're going to redistribute it somehow in the economy, and we'll have a more successful economy. They also then made the argument, pay executives and stock-based pay incentivized to do this, but they created a whole economic theory around what's called maximizing shareholder values that said that this would result in a more successful economy. Now, the theory is totally wrong. It's wrong because, first of all, the people who you're giving this money to take very little risk because they can buy their sell their shares whenever they want, because we have a liquid stock market. The people who take the risks are the people who come to work, work hard today. Sure, they get paid wages, they get a salary, but you're really working hard today, and you're working with other people, and you're learning about how to do things, and you're learning how to market, and you're learning how to purchase, learning how to manufacture, how to do R&D, and put them all together. Because you want to create a future for yourself, and that future is very bound up with the company. So 4 or 5 years after that, when what you did 4 or 5 years before or for several years before starts resulting in products, the competitive products that generating profits for the company, and then the executives invoke maximizing shareholder value to say, well, we can just get rid of you, you're being robbed. And also, we as taxpayers are in the same position. Because although there's this ideology that the government doesn't do anything, that it shouldn't be in the economy, there's no technology that exists in the United States that is of any importance, where for decades the government hasn't first, our taxpayer money really, hasn't been first put at risk in developing it. We then pass it on to businesses, and that's what we need to do, let them produce competitive products with it, but then we need to get some of that money back. And, of course, we know that what's happened is executives say that, and venture capitalists and everybody in the financial community says we need a lower tax rate to incentivize ourselves, us to invest, as if they're the only ones that matter. And, in fact, what you're investing in is people. What you're investing in is a government that is going to invest, provide infrastructure, new knowledge, and maximizing shareholder value just takes that all away. So
you give a couple of examples of this in your piece. ExxonMobil gets $600 million a year in U.S. government subsidies for oil exploration, but spends $21 billion a year in buybacks. You talk about in nanotechnology and pharmaceutical drugs in particular, where there's a
pharmaceutical drugs is a very good example. So I used a number of examples, and I could give a lot of other examples and company examples. Well, we do a lot of research at the company level to see what damage is done, when it occurs, etc. But here's the pharmaceutical example. So we know that in the United States, when we pay for pharmaceutical drugs, it's twice the price anywhere else in the world. Okay, you can say that your insurance policy may pay for it, but then we have higher premiums as a result. Okay. We know that because actually in the UK they regulate drug prices and they put out a schedule every year, and it shows that United States is about twice as what they are anywhere else, including the UK. Okay, so then every once in a while that's been addressed in Congress. The champion in trying to deal with the drug companies was Henry Waxman from California, who I think is just retiring, or is retired.
Yeah.
A few others would say, why are you charging high drug prices? And they would say, because we do so much R&D in the United States, and this is good for keeps the United States as a leading country for the production of pharmaceutical drugs. And if you want all this R&D done in the United States, then we have to have the profits to enable us to do this and decrease our R&D expenditures. Okay. All they needed to do was then say, well, what are you actually doing with the money? And they would see that 50 to 100% of their money, quite apart from dividends, is going to buybacks. And so high drug prices actually just allow companies to do more stock repurchases that boost their stock price, that boost their executive pay. So that's basically what we're paying high drug prices for, is to increase executive pay. Now, the other side of this, however, is even worse than that, because now all those pharmaceutical companies don't have anything in the pipeline.
Right.
And we see Pfizer trying to go abroad and merge abroad to avoid taxes. There's been now, over the last few years, last several years, a collapse of their research capabilities. And they're just extracting value from those companies. So they've actually wrecked the pharmaceutical industry in this company. This is happening in biotech, too. Amgen, which is the leading independent biotech company, started doing buybacks in 1992 and has since then spent more than 100% of its profits doing buybacks. It still has some blockbuster drugs. It's still making profits. Eventually those will run out, and that company will go down the tubes
I have two more questions because we're starting to run short on time here. Before we get to the proposals to fix it, so do we reach a period, and have we reached that period, or is it depend on the industry where the chickens essentially come home to roost? I mean, in other words, obviously, if a company has been doing R&D and been expanding over the course of the years and then begins to taper that off so that they can fund these buybacks, at one point, they can't go any further. Are we starting to see that in pharmaceuticals? Are we starting to see that in other industries? And is there a... Are we
a
decade out?
Yeah. Particularly companies might go to the wall. Like an example is Hewlett Packard. which did tens of billions of buybacks in, I think it was 2010, 2011, I'm not sure to have the years exactly right, but for a couple of years, and then I think it was in 2012, had a $12 billion loss. And that company is going nowhere. Okay. They had actually one of the high-flying stock price in the mid-2000s, even 2006, 2007, even higher than many other companies because while they were, in fact, running the company down. Okay, that company is basically going to the wall. The same action actually happened with BlackBerry, and they started doing huge buybacks when they, somehow they didn't get it that they had to compete with Apple, or maybe their top executives got it and said, okay, let's get our, give our stock price a boost and get out of here. Okay, at some point you see, you know, the end game appears. But for many of these companies, they have such entrenched market positions, like an Intel, Microsoft, ExxonMobil, Apple now, that they can do this stuff for a long period of time and still generate lots of profits and seem like they are companies that, you know, that this is not hurting them. But my argument is it does hurt them. Even those companies, they stop being innovative. It hurts the employees who work for them, and it hurts the economy as a whole, and it basically is just wrong. So I argue, first of all, you should just ban open market stock repurchase by large companies. The only thing they do is manipulate stock prices. We have rules against manipulating stock prices. And not only do they manipulate stock prices, the people who make the decisions have an incentive to do this. So the second thing you have to do is have incentives for top executives that are dependent on the value create, not on the value they extract. And the value they create is, can be measured in many ways by the types, by the higher incomes that the people who help them create value get, and that is often thousands of employees in those companies. And the third thing is, you know, the ways in which companies are governed in this country is totally corrupt. It's all an insider game, and I've have written some other things, including a paper for the Roosevelt Institute, which I wrote in June, called Taking Stock, How Executive Pay Leads to Instability and Inequality in the Economy, where basically you have a everybody, CEOs sitting on each other's boards, and everybody having a community of interest to just get stock prices up. So even when stock prices come down, the board will say, well, oh, you're not making as much money this year. That's not your fault. The whole stock market is down. So let's give you more stock options. Let's give you more stock awards, and we want you now to get your stock price up. And then they go to do the buybacks. They manipulate the market. They start to get the stock price up. They get higher pay. The economy continues to go down the tubes. Mm. So my other recommendation is that we have to change corporate governance structure. We have to put people who really are the value creators have a representation on the board. And that includes workers as a group. And that includes taxpayers as a group. These public companies, the people who run them are employees. Shareholders really are just portfolio investors, people who get in and out, have nothing to do with the company. If they had to know something about the companies, they probably wouldn't hold shares in it. Or if they know something about the company, like a Carl Icahn, who takes a half a 1% per stake in Apple, gets to invite Tim Cook over to his house for dinner, says, let's do $150 billion stock buyback. I think that in itself should be illegal just to be able to have that access. And then has nothing to do with the company, never contributed to that company at all, is just, you know, that those people have to be reined in. They have to be stopped. And so you have this whole other part of this problem, which people, Wall Street. So what does Wall Street have to do with this? Well, I think one of the things that has allowed Wall Street to become such a gambling casino and to have control of so much of the GDP and the economic activity in the country and have even pay there that makes $30 million seem like nothing for a hedge fund manager, that it's all this money flowing out of the real economy through buybacks and can't forget dividends because they've gone up too, that is feeding Wall Street. So for those 450 companies I mentioned before for the last decade, it's about $6 trillion combined, about 3.4 trillion in buybacks, about 2.5 in dividends. That's going into the financial economy, and the people who are getting control of that, what are they doing? They're using their financial power to try to get even more money, extract more money from the economy. So we basically have a value-extracting economy that's totally outweighed the value-creating economy, and we have to bring that under control. And until we do, I think we're going to have just more of the same. We're going to have more concentration of income at the top. We're going to have more disappearing middle-class jobs, more income inequality, more basically profits without prosperity. And so, you know, I'd argue that this is the central economic issue with which we have to deal with in this country.
Bill Ozonek, the piece is Profits Without Prosperity. We have a link to it on our site at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Fascinating stuff.
Okay, thanks a lot.
It's Sam Seder launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
Apparently, even though Lindsey Graham thinks that if President Obama doesn't stop ISIS, we are all going to get killed here at home. Apparently, Lindsey Graham has never met Gary Painter. Who's Gary Painter? Well, of course, he's the sheriff of Midland County, Texas. And the hard-hitting journalist Elizabeth Hasselbeck interviewed him on Fox and Friends. So perhaps Gary Painter should tell Senator Graham to buck up. They're not going to kill all of us, not while he's on the case. Here it is.
County, Texas, who joins us this morning. Sheriff, thank you for being here. What are you hearing? What is this alert about?
Well, I was intelligence report that said that there was ISIS cells that were active in the Juarez area, which is northern part of Chihuahua State, and that they were moving around over there, that they had just that there was some activity, and for the sheriffs along the border to be on the alert, for all law enforcement to be on the alert.
Pause it for a second. Now, when Sheriff Painter says there was ISIS activity, just sort of activity, we don't know whether or not that was they were actually engaging in bombing people, or if it was like they had a bake sale or something, or they were just doing like an outing. But apparently there's ISIS cell activity in Juarez.
They left their soccer jersey on the border.
Well, wait. There's more.
And to be on the lookout for these people maybe trying to come across.
Are you saying that ISIS is ready to come across, poised to perhaps execute what they have threatened to do, attacks on the United States, drown us in our own blood? Is that what you are saying?
Well, I'm saying the border is wide open. There is no control on the border. It's not shut off. There's places along the Rio Grande you can walk across. There's no water in it. I worked the border for 8 years. I walked back and forth across the Rio Grande. I was in Mexico. I was on this side. And never got challenged. And there's always a way to get across. There's coyotes that bring those people across for thousands of dollars, but they'll bring them into that area and then wait when the time is right, and they'll bring them across the river.
Sure, why not?
We have found copies or people along the border where the trails of these people come across have found Muslim clothing. They have found Quran books that are laying on the side of the road or side of the trail.
Pause.
So we know.
So he hasn't found them, but he knows that there are people who have found Muslim jerseys, which we all know as soccer jerseys, and apparently Korans, which, I mean, as you know, Elizabeth Hasselbeck probably knows as an expert, that's the way that Muslims navigate. They will leave a trail of Korans behind them, because they're traditionally the ISIS folk. They're very good at making you drown in your own blood, an entire country, but they don't know navigation skills. So the way they do is they drop Korans.
Salam, you idiot! You didn't put down the Quran. How will we ever get back? First, I have to behead a guy. Now I need to use Google Maps, not the Quran. You are an idiot.
They follow.
I volunteer him for next suicide operation.
They know,
this guy right
they
here.
They know.
Who didn't remember the Quran?
They know that if you leave breadcrumbs, the birds will come and eat it. So they leave Qurans, and that's how they do. That's what people have told
See,
me
even
on
this
the board.
Jew understands. You forget.
There are Muslims that have come across and being smuggled into the United States.
What is your message for the White House? And what is your message for ISIS, ISIL, and terror cells in the making?
If they show their ugly head in our area, we'll send them to hell. And I think the United States need to get busy. And they need to bomb them. They need to take them out. I would like for them to hit them so hard and so often that every time they hear a propeller on a plane or a jet aircraft engine that they urinate down both legs. When you do that, then you've accomplished a lot. And I think General Allen being in charge of it, United States Marine Corps, I think we're going to have, if they'll let him go, let him do what needs to be done. If they'll hit him and hit him hard and hit him often, we need to shut him off. We need to kill him.
I'll give you a big copy of that, Sheriff Painter. We thank you for being with Fox and Friends with a very strong message for the White House and ISIS.
Copy that. Copy that. I don't know if I can handle this.
It's one of the most deliciously
Next up,
stupid pieces
Dennis
of
Miller
sound.
Dolls. What's old is new again. We just need to go and hit them hard and make them urinate down both sides of their legs. Copy that. Copy that.
I just took my Metamucil. Let me tell you, these fellas don't know. Come over that border.
They show their ugly face here. I'm going to show them a thing or two.
When he was describing how hard we're going to hit them, I couldn't help but think of that scene in Borat. You know what I'm talking about, Michael? Where he's like, not even a lizard will survive this bombing.
I'm going to take care of them. They come in. Well, thank God.
I'm working on it.
Folks in Midland County, Texas, are happy.
Space Cowboys meets Red Dawn with Muslim terrorist invasion.
Unbelievable. Let's go to the.
I'm not ready to come out of retirement yet, Rex. Like, they're at the goddamn border. You gonna let them come into our homes?
They're coming in here with soccer jerseys. If I see one more soccer jersey around here, I'm gonna go ballistic. There won't be a soccer ball from here all the way back to all the way around the planet back to right over there. There won't even be room enough for a soccer ball to fit between the areas in which I'll get rid of all soccer. There'll be no soccer. Bring that ugly sport in here where you touch the ball, you get a penalty. Forget it. Copy that. Copy that. I would have loved it if they just went back and forth like three or four times and just copy that. You copy that. Copy that, I will. Well, copy that. Copy that. Copy
no,
that.
Well, excuse me, Miss Hasselbeck. Copy that. If I could just.
That's the way that they. Like, there's two people on the phone. They can't get off the phone.
I like the cockiness.
Copy that.
I appreciate that. This dude is. I like how. I mean, and you know what I think of ISIS guys, but just objectively, these are like seasoned, brutal fighters. Like, literally, they're fighting in a civil war. They're fighting in Iraq. He's just like, nah, I'll take care of them.
I'll take care of them.
They come
to Midland.
They come around here. I think
this is a huge threat. But fortunately for me, I'm a sheriff.
I like that. He's got it. Lindsey Graham is like, even just knowing that they're walking around somewhere, I can't sleep. This guy's just like,
I'll protect you, Lindsey. I'll protect you. Yeah. That's right.
Come in my big, strong arms, Lindsey. I'll hold you.
I'll rock you back and forth. The idea that soccer even exists will just fly from your mind. I'll hold you in such a way that you forget there's ever a sport where you just use your feet. Take you across the Rio Grande, cradled in my arms. All those nightmares about soccer and things like lacrosse, forget about it. Not going to be any sports like that. Aussie rules football, no way. Not when I'm done with them. Not going to be any polo games.
Cricket.
High lie. I don't care where that came from. No more high lie either. Leaving high lie jerseys all over the Rio Grande.
The Muslims have us to play the U.S. Open right there in New York City.
That's right.
Might as well build a ground to the mosque every year.
That's another one, too. No tennis rackets. It's only going to be one sport when I'm done with this.
No Muhammad rackets.
Football.
Let's go to
American football.
Now, Isabel, I know that you have children. You were listening to our conversation about charters. There's also a big...
Well, I don't know if you've been talking about it today because I was on the subway, but did you hear about the school in Brooklyn?
I did hear there was a big protest about the testing, but...
That's right. Because I don't know about your kid. My kid did some major testing this week. And
my kid did too.
But it's fine if it's just a week. But the fact is that he has been studying for the test, prepping for the test for, I want to say, 4 months.
And your kid's in fourth grade.
Yes.
All right. My kid's in third grade. They still get the test too. It doesn't have the same implications. But next week or after vacation, they're going to do another 3 days of math. I today went parents can go in on certain days sometimes to visit the classroom. I went in. The teacher had the parents in there before the kids. The kids were in the hall. The teacher almost, like, literally her voice was cracking as she was talking about, she said, look, the kids did okay. You know, they try and mitigate the whole process for them they give them, like, gummy bears and this and that. But, you know, my kid's 8 years old. She had to take a 80-minute long test 3 days in a row.
3 days in a row that they are, like, cramming and jamming it in there. And this is the test and it's important. And and in fourth grade, they're like, and this, by the way, is going to determine your future.
Yes.
And mine. And
make that clear to the kids.
Oh, yeah.
How do you hide that?
I mean,
that
how could you hide it just with the reality of the
And the
of
reality
time?
Is, that's the reality. And so, you know, you have teachers who are forced to teach to it. And then apparently the big scandal with this is that we are not allowed to know what the test is.
But here's the thing. Okay. So your kid goes to public school and that's part of the deal and you think, okay, there's upsides and downsides, but I'll choose to look at the upsides. Like, not everything in life is fun. Sometimes you have to take standardized tests, LSATs, blah, 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 SATs. So you think, all right, well, at least they're learning some kind of skill in some way, and I'm just not going to just get that angry about it, even though you kind of can. But you hope that the test will be filled with a correct assessment of their reading comprehension and interesting stories. You know, things to read and appropriate things. But this school, and I'm going to read the letter because I got it yesterday from a certain person that I... Okay.
Oh, okay. Isabel Gillies
I have a little inside.
Isabel Gillies with the Intercept over here.
Oh, I don't know how to use technology. I only know how to break into people's email boxes with my phone using a
Isabel
Tor client
Snowden
so that I can't be traced.
Gillies.
He's orchestrating parent-teacher council WikiLeaks, and she can't download an app.
That's right. I'm like cracking down into the deep internet.
I can't possibly download an app, but when it comes to hijacking someone's email box.
Okay.
All right, read the.
This is from the administration. This is from the principal of a public school in Brooklyn. Okay. So it says, our third, fourth, fifth grade have just completed the 3 days of the New York State English Language Arts test. Your children were wonderful, incredibly. They worked hard on the whole, blah, 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 blah. Okay. However, the teachers and administration are truly devastated by what a terrible test it was and how little it will tell us about our students. Because we are bound by test security, we cannot reveal details, but we can tell you that we have never seen an ELA exam that does a worse job of testing reading comprehension. There was inappropriate content, many highly ambiguous questions, and a focus on structure rather than meaning of passages. Our teachers and administrators feel that this test is an insult to the profession of teaching and that student scores on it will not correlate with their reading ability. Because of this, the staff has decided to hold a protest at school of blah, 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 and then they had a protest. I find that I think that's pretty big stuff.
And here's the thing. The teacher says to us today, we come in there because all schools in New York.
Everyone.
Get this test.
Every public
she was,
school.
Yes. She was, her voice was cracking when she was talking about like just sort of the idea of these kids being subjected to this type of testing regime. And longtime teacher, great teacher. And she said, I cannot tell you anything that was on the test. I cannot tell you, I can't, there's nothing else I can say about it. She's like, because of, they are bound by test security. And I asked why, and it's basically because the outfit that does it, it's Pearson, right? Some company that that puts these tests out, I think it is. They want to either, you know, use these tests again in the future and don't want them floating around, which in and of itself is also absurd. Like, you get to do this as a one-off for you guys? You get the you get residuals on this test? It's absurd.
Well, and it's millions and millions and millions of dollars that go behind it, right? It's all connected to all sorts of things. And then, but you can't, they can't even get it right.
And
they can't
even do it
right.
The past tests have been absolutely absurd.
And inaccurate.
And it, this is all just part of, there's just a lot of big money here. Mm-hmm. And
from, whose fault is this? Is it Bloomberg?
Well, I think frankly, you could, Bloomberg, Cuomo, Arne Duncan, President Obama, it goes on and on. President Bush.
Bush,
Bill
right.
Gates,
no child left behind.
There's a...
Because you
waiting
know
for Superman, there's this whole
right.
push to privatize that has multiple. And this is what we talked about actually on the program yesterday, in part with Giroux, Henry Giroux yesterday, was there's a multitude of forces that are acting upon this. One is just sheer profitability. Private tests, private companies. There's also ways of underwriting charter schools and using it as a way of buying properties, and it enriches the people who work there, and they come from certain areas. They have a lot of money. And then part of it is also sort
it's
of
a hedge fund.
Somebody has come from a corporate culture. They impose this on the rest of society. And there's also other benefits that sort of, you know, he talked about how it these are disimagination factories that where the kids – it is a process in which they are detached from the learning process, and these things measure what they are forced to measure are skill sets that are very much depoliticized, and it changes the tenor of the education the kids are getting.
Well, right. And I'll tell you something. Your little 9-year-old, so Thomas, you know, I'm looking at his
brain. Oh, he's not mine.
Nine.
He's yours. He's yours.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,
oh,
8,
I thought you
nine.
Said, your little 9-year-old.
No. Well, no. My, you know. But, you know, I'm looking at his brain and his ability and what he can do. And I say, hey, folks, how about great expectations? How about, you know, why are you wasting this child and all the children? They're all smart and great. All their brain power and concentration and ability to manage stress with this crap. This crap. It makes me so angry that he's basically wasted a year of his life. Because especially after I read that letter, the administration and teachers think it's all hooey.
And just so people understand, particularly in New York in particular, this, you know, this test that you take
it
in
counts.
Fourth grade, it determines what middle school you get into, which determines which high school you get into.
Yeah.
It is.
It's a big deal. And you can get 1, 2, 3, or 4. And
what's the highest?
4.
And that's what Milo's going to get, incidentally.
Well, by the way, so if your kid is
my kid's
dyslexic.
Better than all other kids.
Or has a learning disability or whatever, you're not going to do well because it's, you know, I mean, there are tricks. You can, it's the other thing is that mostly what Thomas did was the teacher gave him a whole bunch of tricks to memorize. Like, you get points if you don't just say in this essay about polar bears declining in the, you know, Arctic regions, blah, blah, blah. You have, if you put the title of the,
Of the piece.
So if you say in this essay, polar bears are going down, you get points. So that's just a trick, right? That's just like then you just...
Sam's writing it down.
No, but I think...
Why
I think,
wouldn't I? That's the problem with this whole process. Would. In fact, we got to talk later because I want the whole list of these tricks.
But don't you think that...
And then I'll send my kid to a tutor to learn these tricks. And then I'll send her to...
For $150 an hour.
Then I'm going to send her to, ELA camp.
Arguably, just really briefly, though, linking back to what you said, Isabel, and in conjunction with what Professor Giroux was saying yesterday, from his perspective, like, that's the point. Why would we want your kid reading Great Expectations or Dickens or whatever when they can be trained to take a test properly, and if they do it well, make potentially a good worker, or if not, forget it. Like, that's the point. And learning the tricks is part of the point, too. Anybody I've talked to who's around the testing industry, they're like, that is the point. It's not knowing
that's
the content.
That's what Thomas said yesterday.
You're measuring
how
what are
the
your
person
tactics.
Takes a test.
What are your tactics? Right. How do you approach? That's the whole thing.
That's right. And that's that Thomas it. Said, it's, I said, well, what, you know, how did you determine your answers, right? And he was like, well, you just get the best possible answer to the question, although there's going to be two or three that also make sense. And I was like, that's sort of sick that you can't write an essay and say, well, you know, there's this, and you can see that from this point of view, but then on the other hand, there's this. It's like no comparative ability. It's just like, because there's going to be little tricks and little ways to screw you up, and but I was quite proud of him for being so you know, mindful of the tricks in some ways, because he was like, I got this down.
Yeah, I mean, but it's sad because it is sad. You know, I have learned how to sort of, you know, it promotes the idea. And that school that Thomas goes to, they did very well in those tests last year, right? I mean,
they did sort of, and everybody else, well, lots and lots of schools did terribly because they made it so much harder.
Yes. Yes.
It's just. I guess maybe it's boring to people who aren't involved with it, but actually, it's not. It shouldn't be because it's
part.
Our
it has
whole
to be seen. It
system.
Has to be. It has to be seen in a just a larger movement to privatize all sorts of things. And it's definitely part of the larger influence that the plutocracy has on our government, I mean, and our society at large. That's the whole point.
I think that's true, but I think it potentially has even deeper roots, you know. I mean, there was this book in the 70s called Deschooling Society, and the point was, and this is just in the industrial era where there wasn't all this debates about privatization, but the point was that school is not designed to produce learning, or until it's designed to produce workers, essentially. And even
then,
in
how
a
come
more,
we're so bad in that and, area?
Right. But even in that context, school is not – the language of what school is supposed to do and what its actual function is are not lined up, and that has very long roots.
Yeah, and I think there's some – I think there's definitely there's some validity to that. But I think a good school and, you know, which provides sort of like broad opportunities and is not about conforming. I mean, that's, you know, one of the things, you know there was one of those success academies moving in to the Upper West Side, right, when we were up there, you know, and they're taking over space at one of the public schools up there. That's a district that has some great public schools already. And they're, you know, I think for a lot of students, it offers some opportunities depending on the neighborhood. What their neighborhood school is about, but also it's very much about sort of like, you know, teaching a lot of these kids to conform to in a corporate sort of process. And some of these schools, you get good outcomes. Some of them, you don't get good outcomes, just like public schools. The only difference is that there's far more oversight over the public schools than there is in these private schools. And
it is so frustrating being on a PA and hearing the administration say over and over again, the DOE, we can't do that because the DOE, we can't do that. I mean, it's like the DOE has an iron grip on all of the learning, all of the funds, all of the, I mean, if they're going to take away your art teacher or your art room, I mean, you know.
This sound from It's completely unrelated, but it is a little bit of war on Easter-ish. And I found it quite enjoyable.
There's something very important in this clip that we'll explain after it, but there's something about the nature of the war on Christmas versus the war on Easter that is revealed in this clip.
Really?
Indeed.
All right. All right, this is from the Sean Hannity show. Apparently, he has invited on to his program a man named Majed Mugni, who is a parent in a class in Michigan. And he complained to school officials because a flyer was handed out in school to all the school kids from a church inviting them to an Easter egg hunt. And, I don't spend a lot of time following these things, but it sounds like one of those things where, you know, this is the this is Fox News's plane for the moment, right? The encroaching war on Easter, or I guess the encroaching problem of Muslims. And they brought on Bob Beckel, who is apparently the go-to guy when you're talking about the problems with Muslims. And this is what ensued.
Pastor of the church, as well as the school district, have both said this is not a religious event, just a day of activity for the community. Joining me now is the parent and attorney.
Pause. I like how the pastor of the church says that this Easter egg hunt at the church is not going to be a religious event. However, how many moments ago was Sean Hannity probably talking about how Hobby Lobby, where a CEO happens to be Christian, it is against his religion to have his employees get health insurance that provides contraception? That's a religious event. But the church, the pastor himself, presumably of the church, says this Easter egg hunt is not a religious event.
Majed Mugni is with us, and the co-host of The Five, Bob Beckel. What's your complaint here, Majed?
Mr. Hannity, I just love how mainstream media puts a twist on the story. First of all, you probably got the wrong fish in your audience. If you're trying to sit here and try to get a Muslim to come up in front of you and tell you how radical we are, you just picked the wrong Muslim. The Muslim in front of you, sir, is one who stood up.
Why are you so angry? All I did was ask you why you're against it.
The Muslim in front of you... Well, let me tell you what the media has put a nice spin on the story.
Why don't you stop whining about it and tell us why you're complaining? What's the big deal? Just I asked you to tell us.
I'm going to tell you right now.
Good,
the story is I'm a parent. You have a church who's decided to pass out flyers to 7 and 9-year-old elementary school kids and invite them to a church event. Well, I have a problem.
They said it's not a church event. It's an Easter egg hunt. So what?
It's distributed by a church.
Now, what's stunning is how much these guys like Hannity will talk about the oppression that Christians suffer in this country. But the idea that an Easter egg hunt at a church is not a religious event, is Sean Hannity aware that people who do not subscribe to the Christian religion perceive Easter as a religious holiday, and that the Easter egg hunt to celebrate Easter is a religious event?
Why are you so angry?
Continue.
Church wants to invite my kids. They can come through the front door, knock on my door, and say, we'd like to invite your kids. They don't have to stick a flyer inside my kid's backpack.
Of a stupid Easter egg hunt? You got to be kidding me.
I'm not outraged. Like I said, Mr. Hannity, you
seem
picked
outraged.
The wrong
you
fish.
Seem angry.
You picked the wrong fit. You know why I'm outraged?
Why
I'm
are
outraged
you outraged?
Because every time Arab Americans stand up for our rights, you don't show it.
Who's you guys?
The entire media.
The entire media.
Now,
the entire media?
When I stood up again, When I stood up for four Christians in Durban who were falsely arrested, what did you guys do? Did you guys cover the story? No, I held a protest. I paid money out of my own pocket. I stood
up
for four
Christians. They have relay races and egg falsely,
and
Easter egg hunt.
They were falsely arrested, and you guys didn't cover the story.
You're flipping out. You're losing your mind.
I'm not flipping out. I stood up, and I held a protest.
Now let's get into the voice of reason. Bob Beckel, who is on the Five. Obviously, he's a Fox contributor. He's got to go on sometimes the prime time. They bring him in when they need somebody to bash Muslims. Here's Bob Beckel, famous for both being the running the campaign for Walter Mondale back in 1984, and also getting busted, extorted by a hooker back in 2002. Let's go.
Against terrorism, and you know...
If I could just interrupt you for a second, I'm delighted to hear that you stood up for the Christians, because it has been appalling to me that the Muslim community, both in the United States and certainly overseas, the presidents of every Muslim nation, the radicals certainly, but the mainstream Muslims, supposedly moderate Muslims, have said nothing. When children get bombed at Boston Marathon, when the coal gets blown up, when the World Trade Center, nothing is ever said. And the only thing you can conclude from that is most Muslims are either complicit in it, they agree with what these radicals are doing, or they're cowards.
Because So we have a guy who's brought on to make it look like Muslims are all outraged and angry and whiny people because they don't want a religious event to be their kids to get religious flyers in their school. And Bob Beckel's first comments are about how all the Muslims don't. Where's all the moms talking about getting into terrorism? Now, of course, all you need to do is Google Muslim religious leaders speak out against terrorism, and you will find thousands of citations of this. Well, I have multiple interns who look at
I asked the young lady in the office, and she was there, she helped, and she looked, and I was there, and then I said something. Anyways, long story short, we went to the HR together because of something I supposedly did. But there was no citation found ever.
I have interns who look at this thing, and I said, find me some Muslim in the day, and they couldn't do it. So
I wonder why you won't say that, but I am glad to hear you say that you don't hate the Christians, but she didn't find it. But she didn't find other things, too, because she was an idiot. So who knows?
Let's continue on with this Bob Beckel bemoaning the fact that this parent of these 7 and 9 year olds in Michigan is the only Muslim in the world who apparently will stand up for Christians.
Mom, not a single imam has stood up or a cleric and said, I'm sorry for what's happened. And you're the first one in the world media. And I congratulate you.
I stood up and thank you. And I stood up in front of the world media and I said, I'm an American. If you want to kill Americans, you terrorists. When the terrorists came and they wanted to blow up a bomber, an airliner in front of the heads of Detroit, I stood up in front of the world and I said, if you want to kill Americans, I'm American. Kill me first.
Okay, well, educate
if you want to bomb Americans, I'm an American.
Why do you think the rest of them are not being so silent? Are they afraid?
Because the media...
Why do you think there are 400 Muslims and they're not saying a single word? And nobody, not a single Muslim spoke out when that prostitute tried to extort all that money from me. She came in there, I gave her $300 per hour, and then she turned around and had $50,000. And her last name was Mussini.
That's Muslim, right?
That's Muslim, but it sure sounds like it. And not a single imam stood up and said, what you're doing to Bob Beckel is absolutely wrong.
So you educate me. So why do you prostitutes steal from me?
I just want to also take this opportunity to thank Sean Hannity for allowing me to get my once-a-month primetime viewers that I need to get for the contributor to come and smack around some Muslims. So...
Because back where I came from, what you do is you don't have a prostitute to rob somebody. You don't blow up the marathon. No, and I want to know why you think that's okay.
1,400 Muslims around the world, not one of them said a single word.
Media does not give us the attention we need. The only reason you guys have me on this show tonight is because you want to make me look like a fool. Well, I'm not a fool. And let me tell you something else. I'm a very educated attorney, and this is what this country needs, educated Muslims that you guys need to put on in front
Mr.
of you.
Moogie.
Listen,
Mr.
listen. Mr. I paid $300,000 in taxes
nobody's,
this year.
Nobody,
I
we invited you on a lot of story. Families. You came on here attacking.
Because you guys.
What do you mean
you guys?
I'm giving you
media,
a voice if you stop
media,
attacking. All right, let me go back to Bob.
Mr. Hannity, thank you.
Right here, $300,000 Muslims attacked.
I ain't going anywhere. Right here.
I love Christians.
Did I say anything?
I stood for Christians.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
And you guys, and I thank you, Mr. Hannity, for finally once giving a Muslim the chance to tell a story.
Mike Gauss is on my program all the time, radio and TV. I don't know what you're talking about. I've invited people on from all different points of view. Bob, I want to ask you this.
Like I said,
is this reaction over the top?
There you go. Not only over the top,
I took her first two, and I got her a burger, so that was a meal. I didn't factor that into the 300, because that was just what I do, because I'm a gentleman. And she still
distracted me. It was a very Christian thing for me to do.
She took the money.
She
took that.
That's
not me. I would call that over the top.
She turned around and tried to extort me. Like, she's some type of like Muslim imam leader coming around and killing Americans. Like, it's gotta be fluff. So.
I just love how Sean Hannity's like, we don't put Muslims in a bad light. We brought you on here to talk about an Easter egg hunt you're outraged about. And now we'll ask you why you didn't apologize for 9/11.
About an Easter egg.
Hey, don't get too upset. You don't have your turban on. You might blow up in your head. I'm sorry, though. But seriously, why didn't you speak out when the girl tried to take my money?
All these people. I caught up one time. I've had 14 hard-boiled eggs in one sitting. They were pickled at the bar. So
that's who I am. That's what I do. And if you don't like it, you're sure right not to like it. It's America. But you can't say that that's okay not to like it because you're a Muslim.
Bingo.
You can see that the secular liberal left and Sam Cedar and us wage the war against Christmas.
That's right.
The Muslims take over for Easter.
That's right.
And they caught that.
We passed the baton because we're too caught up in Passover.
We're busy, so Ahmed, you're going to need to take over Easter.
Please. We're going to be out of school anyways because of the Passover holiday, so we would really appreciate it if some of our Muslim brothers took up the fight against Easter.
We will do, because you know the winter is cold, and we know that you tend to come from warmer climates.
And meanwhile,
so we'll focus on Christmas.
And meanwhile, we will send our prostitutes to overcharge Bob Beckel.
Oh yes, you could send it to Bob Beckel. It's a good idea.
Why would you say anything? I don't know. She might have been Filipino anyways. I don't even know.
We were talking about ENDA and what it is, just the idea of it, the boot of government, socially engineering things. It's not just Red State saying this. It's also Ted Cruz's dad. What's his name, Rafael? Rafael Cruz. Last week we brought you his plea that President Obama be sent back to Kenya, said in perfect English with a slight Spanish accent on behalf of his Canadian-born son, Ted Cruz. And today we bring you the real agenda behind what they're doing. It's not the homosexuals.
It's my favorite sound ever.
Okay, let's hear this.
When you hear all these things about homosexual marriage, this has nothing to do with homosexual rights. Did you know that? The whole objective is the destruction of the traditional family.
Pause it. You see, the homosexual, they don't want rights. They don't care about getting married. No, they've just been signed up to destroy the family.
Has nothing to do with homosexuals. They could care less about homosexuals. They want to destroy the family. You need to understand, it's just like evolution.
Pause it. It doesn't really explain quite yet, but he's getting there. Why do we want to destroy the family? Now, of course, you picky people will tell me how are you destroying the family by allowing people to create families. That is for my second speech that will happen tomorrow.
You know, most Americans have their head in the sand about evolution. I've met so many Christians that tell me, well, evolution is a scientific fact. Baloney! I am a scientist. There's nothing scientific about evolution.
Pause it. You see, baloney is the answer. I have done millions of tests in my laboratory with the baloney. And I rub the baloney on the evolution and nothing changes. It doesn't turn blue.
But you know something? Karl Marx said it. I can use the teachings of Darwin to promote communism. Why? Because communism, or call it socialism if you think communism is too hard a word.
Pause it. This is fascinating here. Like, you don't want to malign Marx too much by saying he was in favor of communism. It's too hard. I don't want to offend Marx. Well, who is he talking to? It's too hard of a word. Yeah, socialism, communism, it's the same thing. They end with an imism.
Necessitate for government to be your God. And for government to be your God, they need to destroy the concept of God. That's why communism and evolution go hand in hand. Evolution is one of the strongest tools of Marxism. Because if they can convince you that you came from a monkey, it's much easier to convince you that God does not exist.
That is because, I will tell you why, Lucy. Because, Lucy, God did not create the monkeys. The monkeys are created by the devil. Because, how do you know this? Because the monkeys have a hand just like their feet. And then what the communist Marxists do is they tell you you can walk on your hands. Now, why did they tell you to do this? Because when you walk on your hands, which way do your eyes look? Backwards. You cannot walk on your hands and look forward. And when you're not looking forward, you bump into things. And you bump your head. You get knocked unconscious, and that is when they bring the communism in. So everybody walk on their hands, and they say, what happened? When Obama says he's going forward, he's a Marxist. Because he wants you to go forward walking on your hands, so you bump into the coffee table. Then you are unconscious, and when you wake up, hey, why is this boot on my thing? And now the gays are getting married. That is the truth. There you go.
I love Ted Cruz's father. That guy is amazing. He's a production assistant for every single progressive media outlet in the country.
I know. Is there a Rafael Cruz newsletter I can get on? Unbelievable. And what's amazing is they're just letting this guy, you know, this guy's just out there. I mean,
Ted Cruz is proud of his dad.
This was just a couple of months ago at the Dean Bible Ministries.
Although he doesn't look like the type of guy, frankly, that you could sit down and say, you know, Mr. Cruz, we might want to tone down. That doesn't seem like...
That? Can I ask, well, I guess Ted Cruz doesn't have an accent. He is more of like a Canadian accent.
Yeah. Hey, Dad. Hey. All Dad, the crazy talk.
Is there any chance that you could maybe not talk so much about the evolution?
I think you know and I know that the gays... in conjunction with the evolutionists, are planting the fossil evidence for Satan.
Can't we?
That's common sense. But some people don't want to hear it up front.
Agenda 21. Unbelievable. Listener, gotta love America, where a Canadian-born Latino can win on being an immigrant-hating Southern supremacist. Jesus was a lefty. They're all over the country. There's at least four guys in Orange County, where I used to live, driving four different Batmobiles around. Local paper actually did a piece on them. Wow. Captain Kangaroo, just an observation. I've yet to see an example on GOP TV of anybody losing their insurance and having to pay more. Every time GOP TV rolls out, some clown claiming they have lost their insurance and have to pay double for worse insurance, it always turns out to be a lie. Has anyone seen a true example of someone losing their insurance and having to pay more to replace it? You would think if they existed, GOP TV would find one. I am sure there are people out there. It's inevitable, but
why find those people when you could find the ones they're bringing out?
Well, and why find those people when it might be, you know, a marginal difference?
When you, yes, when and you what about the monkeys?
They say it's a marginal difference. I say do not understand what the marginal difference is. You have to see his face in the clip when he says baloney.
Baloney.
It is like
he's a baloney.
He just looks so enraged.
He man. Well, he hates baloney.
That's what he says when he sees it. Baloney.
Let's look at the list for the grocery market. Turkey, thin sliced, mortadella. Thin slice. Bologna. I will now buy bologna. You can have bologna, but I will not buy the bologna. Now he's like Italian, like an old Italian.
Castro is a very bad leader.
How come Fidel Castro lives forever? It is, it's only baloney. Such an apple pie.